So before I begin, I want to tell you a little bit about myself and why this is a topic that interests me. And I'm very excited about the panel that we have following this overview. I hope you guys learn a lot. But before I tell you a little bit about myself, I want to do a little word association. So if you have a piece of paper and a computer, or a computer, if that's how you're taking notes, I want you to write down the first thing that comes to your mind when I say these two words. So the first one, when you hear poverty, what do you think of? What do you think? And write it down. And then also write down what the first thing you think of is when you hear the word asset. And we will come back to that at the end. So my name is Kate. I work for the Oklahoma Policy Institute. I also coordinate our Asset Building Coalition, which I'll talk a little bit more about. We are a group of individuals and organizations that work to promote programs and practices and policy that enable people to build strong financial foundations for themselves and for their communities. A little more on a personal note, why this is an issue that has always been of some importance to me. I was the first person in three generations of my family to graduate from college with a bachelor's degree. My father's parents immigrated from Eastern Europe after World War II. My mother's parents were children of the, Dust Bowl, children of the Great Depression. And I have experienced personally how having, no access to opportunity and having access to many opportunities to learn and build wealth can really determine the course of your life, for better or for worse. I grew up in a military family. I lived on military bases my whole life. And because of that, through the United States Air Force, my family and myself, my brothers and sisters, had access to stable employment that paid living wage, affordable housing, universal health care. We had basic low-cost financial services through credit unions. We were able to access low-interest loans to finance assets like cars, homes, and secondary education. We also had ease of access to grocery stores with a healthy variety of food that was untaxed. We lived in integrated and diverse communities. There were a plethora of after-school care and youth and family enrichment programs available. And I mean, last but not least, I feel like I received a really world-class education. I went to a public school on military bases, but we had really high-quality teachers, small classroom settings. And all of those things that I just mentioned were available to every family and every person that lived or was active duty military, not just the people who joined up with the most education or the most money or the commanders or officers who earned the most money. They were available to everybody. And all of those things that I just mentioned are also not welfare programs. They're not entitlement programs. They're not really handouts. They are opportunities. And none of them are a guarantee of being able to be prosperous or build assets. You could still make poor decisions. You could have a poor work ethic or just a disregard for those opportunities and still end up broke at the end of the day. But the key word is opportunity. And all those pieces that I've described are really necessary stepping stones to building those assets that you need to be financially stable and that you need to build the kind of wealth that you can pass on to the next generation. And almost all of those pieces that I've described are just simply unavailable to most low-income civilian families and many middle-income civilian families in the United States. So I consider myself very lucky, and it shaped the way I think about this issue and encourage you as I go through the slides to think about which of these pieces were available to you and which weren't, and how that might have made a difference in your life in a way that you hadn't considered before. So I'm going to just briefly discuss the idea of poverty, and then I want to talk about the difference between something like a safety net program like SNAP, more commonly known as food stamps, and a few other programs, the difference between those types of programs and asset building, which are really programmatic or structural things that enable people to be self-sufficient and financially secure over the long term, and things that our panel will definitely talk about after this. And then I'm going to present just a little bit of some data and a few, a little bit of detail about what poverty, particularly asset poverty, looks like in Oklahoma. And then I'm going to talk about intergenerational wealth, how wealth moves between generations, and the wealth gap that is, ever present in the United States and in many other places. And then hopefully, although not sure if I will have time for this, we may leave the last portion to our panel, who will definitely talk about what they are doing and what the programs they work with and partners that they work with do to expand economic opportunity in Oklahoma. I also have a couple little videos and clips for y'all in case you're tired of being talked at. So the first thing, poverty is relative. I don't know if you hear this as much as I do. You see it on the news sometimes. It's sort of a sub-theme that people will point out that, well, if you're poor in America, not really poor, you don't have a distended belly and you're not starving literally to death. Some point out that for some people, they are, but I also point out that that doesn't mean that you're not impoverished. I mean, literally starving to death is not a necessary part of the definition of poverty. It's relative. The way that the dictionary defines poverty is someone who lacks the usual or socially acceptable amount of money or material possessions. It's definitely something to think about in context. Poverty is the difference between the resources that you have available and what you need. So whether that's how much money you have in your bank account and you run out at the end of the month because you aren't paid enough to pay both your rent and your gas and for food and for everything that your kids probably need every day. I don't know, I have kids, but I hear they're expensive. But so scarcity of resources is a really key marker of poverty. And of course, what we would be most concerned about, and that's what safety net programs are for, difficulty meeting those basic needs. So if you don't earn enough or are unable to work for a variety of reasons to pay for a roof over your head, for enough food to be healthy, for basic health care, for clothes, those very, very basic things. And that's something that, a central feature of poverty, that is the reason that we're concerned. That's the reason that I'm up here talking to you. Fine folks today. And then the last thing I want to point out, just because I'm certain that you hear about it, we won't talk much about the federal definition of poverty because we're going to shift away from thinking about poverty in terms of income, and we're going to talk about poverty in terms of assets and wealth. But this is a rubric on the left column where it says 100%. This is what the federal government and then the states cooperatively administer most of the anti-poverty programs. Those are the income cutoffs to be officially above or below the poverty line. And then you might notice 133, 150, 200 when, if you registered on the exchange or you've been reading about the Affordable Care Act, those are just simple calculations for determining whether you're eligible for certain tax credits or some other nonprofits and other programs use the same federal standard. $11,670 a year. Does that sound like enough money, anybody? Okay. So using that definition, this is several years of data in Oklahoma of our poverty rate versus the rest of the country. We're consistently higher, and we rank right now 16th in the country in terms of just the basic poverty rate. And then I'm not going to go through a lot of these sort of sub-pieces of data, but we provide a poverty profile on our website, and I'd encourage you to go to okpolicy.org, go to poverty under issues, and then you can look at the way we fare when looking at income poverty, how much money you earn at a job, what you have coming in, you know, with every paycheck, you can see how that breaks down by a variety of different factors. So the safety net is inadequate for a number of reasons. Increasingly, the eligibility guidelines are more and more and more stringent. Some of these programs, you're excluded altogether if you do not have children, just categorically excluded. And the one in the middle, TANF, what you see there, does anyone know what that stands for? Yes. And that was a program that until the late 90s was known by, you know, under a different acronym, but is popularly known as, quote, welfare, which, newsflash, and this is not breaking news since it happened in the late 90s, but doesn't exist anymore. Pretty much the contract with America in the late 90s and the Welfare Reform Act dismantled welfare as we knew it for low-income families with children in the United States. And now we have a version of what previously existed, but it is available to very, 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 very few families, and it is time-limited and lifetime-limited for those families. So it's inadequate for that reason and for another reason as well, but I want to show just a little bit of data. We don't have time to go through all the programs, but here's just a short clip, a piece of the puzzle. This is during the most recent recession. In 2009, pretty much overnight, the state of Oklahoma lost about 50,000 jobs. We've gained them back and relatively, in some ways, doing better than the rest of the country. But the recession did hit Oklahoma. It's not like we were skipped. And what TANF is supposed to do is provide replacement income or support income for now only single parents with children while they look for another job, get job training skills, or sort of stabilize, basically. These are the red columns are the number of children living in families where no parent in that family has full-time year-round employment. And then the little green bar is the number of children that year that were enrolled in the TANF program. Very, very few. So I'm going to show a very short clip as another, you know, glimpse into the inadequacy of the safety net serving income poor in the United States. A Place at the Table, you can watch it on Netflix, it's a really phenomenal documentary about food and how much more expensive it has become, how inefficiently distributed it is, and how nutritionally bankrupt most the food that most low-income families can afford to purchase or have nearby is. And this is just an interview with a mom and her adorable little children. And I will let her. So I've provided a glimpse at two programs, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance, food stamps, and TANF. So not only are those safety net programs inadequate in the sense that, you know, they're clearly not keeping up with the price of food and not, the eligibility guidelines are not providing access to as many people who need that support, but those safety net programs, neither of them are designed to alleviate poverty. Neither of them. One of them is designed to provide temporary job training, other programmatic support, and a very little bit of money, a couple hundred dollars a month on average, to, you know, clothe children, put gas in the car for a short period of time. And then, of course, SNAP is designed to provide food. That's it. That's all you can buy with SNAP is groceries. So assuming that even both of those programs were adequate and comprehensive, they will never, ever, and nor were they designed to provide an opportunity for any of the families or individuals that use them to take a step up. So I want to sort of introduce the concept of wealth and assets. And the reason that that is related to stepping up is, the more money you make. You can, you know, get raises at your job and make enough money that you sort of rise above the need for some of those safety net programs. But in the medium to long term, and for the next generation in your family, being able to build wealth and assets that can be there for you through any, you know, shock in your life, the loss of a job, the loss of a loved one, an illness, variety of things that might happen, having tangible financial assets, things like a bank account or a retirement savings account, are incredibly important throughout your entire life to stay financially stable. And when we think about wealth as not money coming in the door from your job, it changes the way we look at poverty. So there are two kinds. I alluded to a few of them just now, having a tangible asset, actual money in an account. What do you think is the most popular, most widespread type of asset that an American household? Do you say cash? Well, I don't know about that. Yes, a house, a home. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. And then there are, of course, a whole lot of intangible things that you need to ever get there. If you don't have a living wage job or a job that pays you well enough to qualify for a mortgage to buy a home, then you'll never get there either. So you've got to have the proper skills and education to get there. So there are some more intangible things as well. The way that we think about it over a lifetime is using these three categories. You have the foundational things. Many of you are working on one of those right now. Skills and education. You have to be healthy enough to work and physically capable. And also your household. You know, if you have dependents that need your care or need you to, you know, need you there and can't work full time, that can prohibit your ability to work. So those health, education, and transportation, which of course being able to get to work. You need those before you can ever even think about earning a cash income or a paycheck. Generative assets, that's employment and income, that money that comes in through your labor, through your work. And then lastly, these are really the big ticket items, regenerative assets. These are things that you can purchase and invest in that over time generate income independent of your labor. Sounds great, doesn't it? So here's what asset poverty in Oklahoma looks like. I'll let y'all take a look at that for a second before I explain. So we'll talk a little bit later about the racial wealth gap and inequality in Oklahoma and in the United States, and we certainly saw the foundations of that on our tour. Was that just yesterday evening? Last night. The roots of the wealth gap are numerous and generally pretty clear and frequently very violent, as we all learned a lot last night from DeMario about. This is the rate of asset poverty if you compare white households with households of color. If you do not have sufficient net worth to live at the poverty level for 3 months if you were to lose your job or lose your income temporarily for some reason. So that's a savings account, that's a liquid asset, something that you could immediately tap to pay your bills, buy your food, do things like that. Nearly 40% for households of color and a little over 20% for white households. So I want to go through just a snapshot. There are many, many, many types of indicators you could look at to gauge where Oklahomans stand with foundational assets, with generative assets, with regenerative assets. Many of them you've heard about already, and you'll hear about the rest of the program. 7.5% of households in the state went hungry at some point during the year because they couldn't afford food. That's very bad for your health, especially if you're a young child, and can significantly affect your development over the long term and your earning capacity. Several hundred thousand Oklahomans have no health insurance. So not only can that jeopardize your health, but that can also devastate your earning capacity and your savings and ruin your credit. So not having health insurance in Oklahoma definitely puts your foundational assets at risk, and the others as well, as they build on each other. Malnutrition because of lack of food or lack of healthy food, poor health, or an untreated illness can inhibit your ability to work, drain your assets. You could miss more work, you could lose your job, you start racking up debt. Educational attainment in Oklahoma is also fairly poor compared to other states. There was a robust discussion this morning. You all have been talking about that for most of today. Our schools are underfunded. The infrastructure of our schools are badly neglected. In 67 of the 77 counties in Oklahoma, two-thirds or more of adults have not completed 2 years of education after high school. So vo-tech, college, things like that. Generative assets. This is a job, pretty much. Or starting a business can also be a generative asset. Certain places in Oklahoma and in certain communities and demographic groups, the data is alarmingly clear. Unemployment is much higher, and that's at every level of educational attainment, even folks with bachelor's degrees, PhDs. People of color in Oklahoma are much more likely to be unemployed. Overall in Oklahoma, we are a low-wage work state. So nearly one in every three jobs is in an occupation where the median pay is below poverty. And that's been growing ever so slightly for the last 5 to 10 years. We generally rank in the top five, kind of vacillate the top five of all states in the share of all the jobs in the state that meet that definition, that are low-wage jobs. We also have a lot of folks in Oklahoma that are not fully employed, which means they could mean a variety of things. They might have a part-time job but really need a full-time job and can't find one. Or they can find a full-time job but they don't have a car to get them there, so they work somewhere else instead. And then we also have a lot of low-income working families in Oklahoma. So 73% of the Oklahoma families that are below 200% of the poverty line work. These are working households. They're just not earning enough to save and build assets. Incarceration and criminal justice is something we've already talked a bit about, and if you participate in that breakout session, you'll learn more about. But the films that we saw, highest female incarceration rate, incredibly high incarceration rate overall, many, many nonviolent drug offenders. We'll definitely have panelists speak about this as well. That just devastates a person and that person's household's ability to earn money and save money, both directly, just not being able to work while they're incarcerated, but fees, fines, being caught up in that system, and then just being able to find a job that pays well and pays enough. There are many, many barriers. So the last thing that I want to talk about: intergenerational wealth, economic mobility, and the wealth gap. And then we'll turn it over to our panel. This is a short video from the Pew Research Center, who has been conducting this research for over a decade now, looking at people during their prime working years all over the United States and comparing the states and examining the idea of relative versus absolute mobility. Is the American dream real? Is it true? If you start out in the bottom bracket in terms of income, you're born into a very, very low-income family, what are the chances in your state that you will move into that next rung, or maybe even get to the top rung? And it does a really excellent job of displaying the concept of mobility. So I want to take a moment to... So if you go to their website, you can look at the map and you can see how Oklahoma fared compared to other states in folks during their prime working years, how they moved relative to other people in the state. Oklahoma had both the lowest absolute and the lowest relative upward mobility compared to every other state in the country. There were, I forget which two, there were a couple of other states in that same group with us, but we were in the bottom of both. And we were at the top in terms of downward mobility. So 33% of Oklahomans move down 10 or more percentiles of the earnings distribution ladder during their prime working years of their life. Not great. So this is the last video that we're going to watch, and I think we have about 5 or 6 minutes, just enough time to watch it and absorb it a little bit before we turn it over to the panel. I want you to think about the tour yesterday evening, and when we talk about things that happened, you know, they seem like they happened a really, really long time ago. You know, the Greenwood massacre happened in 1921. What you'll see here in this video occurred immediately after World War II, the specific, you know, in the years after that, the specific phenomenon they'll be discussing. Yet, because of the way that wealth is transferred, the effects of those instances of violence or asset stripping or outright, you know, public policy discrimination in terms of who is allowed to build wealth and who is not are present still today. Your grandparents and parents are the conduits of wealth for your family and for your community. So this is from a PBS documentary that is a 6-part series, and it's just a very short clip about the federal housing infrastructure in the United States. And given that a person's home is usually their primary asset in the way that they both save money and build wealth, it is pretty impactful. Okay, this is the last thing I want to show you all. I've gone just a few minutes over time, but it's pretty important. So I've picked an example from each type of asset to really illuminate, hopefully, both the racial wealth gap and just in general how the intergenerational wealth transmission occurs. These are two actual people that fought in World War II. The gentleman on the right was an officer who was many decades later awarded the Medal of Honor by President Clinton for his actions during the war. And the gentleman on the left was an enlisted, undecorated veteran of World War II. Equity, regenerative assets. As you saw from that video, when he returned from the war, would have been able to, you know, he and his family both purchased a home for a very, very, very low interest rates, but also pretty much be guaranteed a community that would contain other houses around it that would appreciate in value because the banks were only lending and were lending at very, very low rates to those communities. And then that equity, of course, could have been used to do anything that, you know, they chose to do with that those assets. College loans and subsidies that came along with the GI Bill. He could have gone to Votech or to college for no money or very, very little money out of his pocket. And whereas the Army officer, Baker, would not have been able to buy a home, and in most places would not have been given admission to college or university to earn a 4-year degree at that time. Finally, I mean, an example of generative assets. So that's regenerative, foundational assets, education, and then employment. When black soldiers returned from World War II, they were reentering a labor market that was very segregated. They were only, for the most part, afforded access to low-wage jobs that were insecure and that had few benefits versus, you know, the white men returning would have had much more opportunity to secure, both because they, would have an education and also just by nature of them being white, to secure a stable living wage job with plenty of benefits to help them build assets. So you could pretty much put anybody's picture in each of these two columns if you think about Tulsa. You know, someone who lost their home or their business in the massacre versus, you know, someone who didn't, and that home, that wealth is still in their family, you know, a couple of generations later versus being gone forever. So there are a lot of instances in American history where you could put different people in these shoes and see how a wealth gap was created. And the bottom line really is to keep that in mind, both to understand the gap when you see it. So much of it was created structurally many years ago and has little to do with, current policy or behavior, but also to remember that when there are solutions proposed and, you know, depending on your political philosophy or your approach to those things, some that you are more inclined to agree with or not, that we have always used public policy in America to reward certain people over others, and that has created some very enormous gaps and have really just a retributive and asset-stripping approach for many, many people of color in the United States. And so we cannot forget that history, and it's still with us every day. And I think that is my time. So I'm going to invite our panelists to come take the stage. And I want y'all to look back down at your word association, poverty and assets. See if you might think of something different now. Come on down, y'all. Welcome, everyone that I haven't had a chance to say hello to yet. So we have with us this afternoon a group of people who every day work to expand access to economic opportunity for all Oklahomans. And they do it in very different ways and for different groups of people, but I will say do it very well. We have Chris Steele, who is currently the executive director of TEAM, the Education and Employment Ministry, and is the former Speaker of the House for the state of Oklahoma. I'm just going to give little brief introductions, and then I'll let y'all take it away each to do your introductions. We have Christina Astarzo-Mendoza, who works with the Community Service Council and community schools on a program called Conexiones, which works with Hispanic and Latino youth and families on high school completion and education. We also have Marilyn Fever, who is currently the executive director of the Southwest Oklahoma Impact Coalition. It's a 20-county regional economic development planning group. So we're very excited to have her here and share some real insight into what the state, people in the state and businesses in the state and universities are doing to create a more favorable environment for higher paying jobs and comprehensive and full employments. And last but not least, we have Christy Finsel, all the way from St. Louis, Missouri. So she actually coordinates a program that's very similar to the one that I discussed at the beginning, Oklahoma Assets Network. She is the coordinator of the Oklahoma Native Assets Coalition, and it I will let you say your mission statement, but she also does asset building programming with Native Nations and tribal citizens in the state of Oklahoma. So I will turn it over to Chris to talk a little bit about what he does.
Great. Thank you so much, and thank you for the opportunity to get to be here today. I'm excited to engage in this discussion. Hopefully we'll get to share some things that will provoke some thoughts within yourselves, and hopefully if all goes well, I'll learn some things too. So currently I work with TEAM, which is a nonprofit in the greater Oklahoma City area that is actually dedicated to breaking the cycle of incarceration and poverty through education, character development, and work readiness training. And I will tell you that the main focus of what we do is to find employment for individuals who are actually reentering society from incarceration and in the process of rebuilding their lives. Just because a person has been impacted by incarceration does not necessarily mean that they're also in poverty. However, I will say that it's awfully difficult to obtain employment once you have a felony conviction or once you try to rebuild your life with the stigma of having been incarcerated. And as you all know, I know that you've already discussed a little bit on the issue of incarceration, the incredible impact that it has not only on the individual but also on their families. There are some statistics in our state that indicate as many as 70%, 7 out of 10 children of incarcerated parents become incarcerated at some point in their lives, so it truly becomes a generational issue. And I will tell you that at TEAM, we do focus on the employment piece. We focus on getting a person equipped and empowered and ultimately able to secure employment, and not just the first job that they can find. And we really have to work at this, because when a person is able to reenter the workforce, they're willing to take the first job that comes their way. And sometimes that's what has to happen. But more than that, we want to be able to develop a career path for that individual so that they can obtain a living wage and ultimately provide for their family. And we do that through tangible job training skills, through education. We do a lot of cognitive behavior sort of courses so that we can work on how to appropriately process and deal with the common stressors that affect the workforce. We work on healthy communication, effective communication, healthy relationships, anger management, financial literacy, all that good stuff, in addition to just getting a person ready for work. We partner with several employers in the Oklahoma City area that actually come into our facility and help with the job training piece. Chesapeake is an industry, energy industry business that comes in and actually teaches effective interviewing techniques, and we partner with our Career Tech and Community College as well. One of the unique things that we do at Team that we've just added recently is if a person is obtains employment and is able to advance through a certain type of credentialing or additional education, and we're not able to provide that in-house, we will pay for that job training and education at the community college or at the Career Tech Center for that individual. And we help them with any work-related items that they need, work apparel, tools, equipment, transportation, and then ultimately housing as they begin to rebuild their life. And then we also put together, surround that person with a support system. Each of our participants is matched with an individual mentor in the community that can walk with them and support them and provide structure and accountability into their life, as well as a case manager. And we think that that's very important as they begin their new journey in our community. And so that's a little bit about what we do and why we exist. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Christina?
First off,
yeah, I think
can
so.
You hear me better now? Thank you. First off, I want to say thank you to Katie for inviting me. And thank you to all of you who have started this journey of learning about not just about Tulsa, but Oklahoma, and I hope that you can bring this information back to your communities and make them stronger. I coordinate a program called Conexiones, which is out of the Community Service Council, and Conexiones, just to kind of give you a brief overview, is a birth through 20 initiative. So we look at the systemic and also local, national issues that might affect and influence the success of Latino students in the Tulsa area. We work a lot with community partners, shout out to OSU, Center for Family Resiliency, and DreamAct Oklahoma, because they are what helps us as a collective impact strategy make things move locally. Let's see, we look at really closely at early childhood development. We look at early literacy. We look at family engagement, also ways that we can involve youth that might be first-generation immigrant in youth development programs. Also, we look at gang prevention and also high school completion. And while, yes, we do look at, we focus mostly on high school completion. Lately, we've been encouraging a lot of local businesses and nonprofit organizations to hire Latinos and include them kind of in their work so that in overall we can have a bigger impact with amongst all the organizations in the community. And then also increasing access to scholarships, internships, and other things that kind of improve the professional growth of our young people. Lately, we just got received the news that we were accepted for a W.K. Kellogg grant, and we're calling it the Power of Families. Right. And this is going to really look at some of our community schools and ways that we can be including the Latino families that have young children, not only connecting them to local resources, but actually making those Latino families as part of the decision-making processes that happens. So making them real change agents. So that's why we're calling it the Power of Families. I'm really excited for your questions, and yeah, that's all I have.
Thank you. Congratulations.
Good afternoon. I'm Marilyn Fever. I am the Executive Director of the Southwest Oklahoma Impact Coalition, a 20-county area in southwest Oklahoma. So just in your mind, envision a map of Oklahoma. We're everything south of Interstate 40 and west of Interstate 35. It's a large area, especially when you only have one employee, and that's me. We were literally founded at a coffee shop in Weatherford by SWASU's president and a couple of other guys who had a napkin on the table, and they started writing down the premise of what an organization like ours should look like. And basically, the number one thing was rural Oklahoma is worth saving. And we are very rural. I think all of Oklahoma is rural. We are really rural. We have towns, literally, that have dried up. And I know this happens everywhere, but little communities like Roosevelt and Cooperton and Godibo and Mountain View. And we have a few strongholds in our region to include, you know, Lawton, Fort Sill, Duncan, Altus, Weatherford, Chickasha. But for the most part, we're very, very rural. So we decided what we needed to do is figure out how to tackle the issue of declining population in this region. So, like any good economic development person would do, we jumped out and started surveying business and industry, and in the end, over a two-year period, talked to roughly 600 businesses. These were major manufacturers and small businesses as well. So they told us all the impediments to growth. We heard it all. But I can just tell you right off the top of my head, the number one issue was the quality and the quantity of the workforce. So after working on other issues that are still very important to us, like water resources, quality child care, access to health care, there are a handful of others, we came back and decided that where we could make the most impact was working on the workforce issues. We are now championing, after a long cycle of, you know, just revisiting this over and over and over, we are now championing career pathways across the state of Oklahoma. We're very focused, obviously, in our region, but we've stepped out beyond southwest Oklahoma and working with other communities in the state. So I don't want to make it sound like I'm the only person who does anything. We have a lot of great volunteers. We have a group called the Frontline Team of people who are on board to go anywhere to help other communities get started. We have a pilot in the Duncan Public School and community right now. So I, too, am looking forward to your questions as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Christy Finsel, and as Kate mentioned, I'm the executive director of the Oklahoma Native Assets Coalition, and we work with the 39 federally recognized tribes in the state of Oklahoma and Native nonprofits to try to increase, basically, the number of Native asset-building programs in the state. We are led by a group of Native asset-building practitioners. And I'm a member of the Osage Nation, and we're located here. Our seat of government is in Pawhuska, Oklahoma, and that is not that far away from Tulsa. As Kate mentioned, I do live in St. Louis, and I'm in and out of the state frequently for this work. And then I do other asset building work nationally as a consultant. And so just briefly, a little bit of our history. We met first some Native asset building practitioners. So these would be a lot of program directors from tribes. They started meeting in about 2001, and then it took until 2007 for something to kind of more formally come together. In 2009, we started getting some funding from the Ford Foundation, and then kind of moving forward, we've been working with a fiscal sponsor, and then last month we were notified that we did receive 501c3 status, so we'll be moving in that direction now. In terms of what we do, we try to provide constituents with models, resources, a lot of peer learning opportunities, some funding, so we did offer mini grants for the first time this year. Of the 39 federally recognized tribes, there was interest from 15, and that was just for the first round, and these were $3,500 grants. So I think there is quite a need for some flexible funding for tribes to be able to pull these programs off. We have an annual conference. We just held ours in July. We try to provide forums to talk about any kind of tribal, state, federal policies that affect the work that we're doing. And we also provide free training and technical assistance. So for some of these tribes, if they were going to design, for example, a children's savings account program, they might wish to work with us to help do the design features on that, and we can provide it for free. That could be anywhere from a $5,000 to $30,000 in-kind service for them, and so we try to let people know that's available. When I say asset building, what exactly program-wise are we talking about? That could be financial education programs, as I mentioned, children's savings accounts to help create a nest egg of savings, match savings accounts or individual development accounts to help people save much more quickly to purchase a home, small business, post-secondary ed, or more culturally relevant purchases as well if the funding is flexible, credit builder programs, small business resource, homeownership assistance, etc. And then just kind of briefly, how are we connected here to the Oklahoma Policy Institute and then Oklahoma Assets Network. Currently, we are both under that Building Economic Security Over a Lifetime initiative from the Ford Foundation, and we are tasked as a Native coalition to specifically work with the tribes in the state and then communicate and work and collaborate as we can with the Oklahoma Policy Institute and Oklahoma Assets Network as they also work with other communities of color in the state to close the racial wealth gap. So thank you for the opportunity to be here. Look forward to this conversation.
Thank you. So thank you all for being here. Students, a couple of things. I'm going to start us off with a couple of questions for the panel, but I would like y'all to be thinking about what you want to know. I feel like a lot of the programming by necessity has been a bit of a downer sometimes, but right now we have people in front of us who all work to expand economic opportunity in Oklahoma, and they're doing innovative things to make that happen and also just to elevate our consciousness around some of those issues. So anything that you would like to know from them about the particular communities they work with, what their barriers are, what successes they've had, please don't hesitate to ask after I get the ball rolling here. And I also would love to hear anybody's reflections on their word association game, if they had made a connection for yourself when you look kind of back down at what your initial thoughts were, and now hearing some of the data and hearing from these folks what contrast sort of comes to mind for you. We've already got one question. I am still going to kick it off, not because I don't think your question is important, but because I think this is a good framing issue, so I'm glad that you're ahead of the curve. So I want to direct this question to Marilyn Fever first, and then anyone else on the panel that would like to comment, please do. What role would you say a good job plays, having a good job, and that might be speak to a skills issue for a worker or a need for an employer, and what barriers do you see to creating, finding, and keeping a good job? And what's working for the Impact Coalition in your efforts with employers and members of the workforce?
Well, obviously, and I think everyone in this room would agree, can you hear me okay in the back? Mm-hmm. You can't get a good job without education. And I'll just focus on that a little bit. Education is your passport. We all know that. Everyone in this room, again, knows that. Education is the passport to the American dream. It is the passport out of poverty for those people who don't realize it yet. So to answer the question, the premise of our work in economic development, and our organization started purely from the economic development perspective, but now we've swung over to the education perspective, because those two things are really tied together. You cannot separate community development, social development from economic development. They're just tied together. So I forgot the question. So what role does
that, you know, whether it's having a prepared workforce or for the worker themselves, what role does having access to and creating those good jobs play in their overall financial stability of the community or household?
Okay, so I did work in economic development as an ED professional for nearly 20 years before I took this particular role. And the first thing a company or an existing employer wants to know are, what are the skills of your workforce? You cannot recruit new business and industry or help sustain those that exist in your community right now without a skilled workforce. Without opportunity for new jobs, young people will not be able to stay in the community. And so what happens to your community is your population dwindles, your tax resources dwindle, and that's why you see the rural areas of the state particularly declining. So good paying jobs are the foundation for economic growth and sustainability in any community, no matter the size or location of the community. So back to the first premise again, it all rolls back around to education, and that's why SOIC, the name of my organization, after focusing on infrastructure issues and other things, decided we could only make significant impact in the creation of wealth in Southwest Oklahoma by working on the education attainment of the people who live there.
Thank you. Did anyone else want to jump in? Christy?
Okay. You know, I would say that across the country, when we're working with Native communities, we hear that people want to be able to come home, and they want to be able to stay in their local communities. They want to be able to connect culturally, and they want to be able to have jobs that they can sustain their families with. And so there is a great incentive among Native communities here in this state who are place-based and are supposed to now stay in these places for perpetuity, to be invested in making sure that we have the ability to have good jobs. And so we, you know, trying to think about this really broadly. So how do you get people prepared, obviously, to be able to go into the workforce? So starting early. So some of this interest in children's savings accounts, for example, as a way to build up some nest eggs so that people have money to go on to school and feel like they have options to be able to come back home. That's a piece of the puzzle, I think. We do have some tribes that have scholarships that are available to try to help tribal members be able to go to school. And then we have tribes that are designing business incubators. I think those are really interesting job training programs. Really, this big issue about broadband in rural areas is an important piece to this puzzle as well, you know, to be able to have the industry at home. So there are some tribes that are trying to think about how to go in and do some broadband work. Really kind of plugging the leak economy. So, I mean, you have the opportunity here. We have Native nations that are supposed to serve everyone in their community. So we have the social services that we need there. We need, you know, all the infrastructure in place. And so how do we make sure that we can support the local businesses that are there? And some of them are tribally owned and some are not. So thinking about that too. So I would say that all these pieces kind of come together, and it's not just, you know, one piece, but we're thinking about all of this as we are trying to think about asset building and economic development in Native communities.
Okay. Yeah, if I may, I think part of my work is actually defining what is a good job for some of the Latino students, because they do see, you know, their older brother who's a mechanic. They might see, you know, their cousin who's a landscaper, and they get paid. They can get paid a pretty good livable wage. However, a good job really helps with the sustainability. So even when there is bad weather, you can rely on being able to make an income. You can also rely on sick pay. You can rely on health insurance. So that's something that, you know, as for a young person, you might not immediately think about, especially if you're in middle school. But, you know, it's kind of informing young people, like, what does a good job mean? And so helping them kind of change their mindset about what is possible for them and what is really needed to live in today's world. So I really try hard to communicate that to young people, and then also with their families, because a lot of times they feel maybe restricted, or they might not know what is available out there in terms of opportunities, scholarships, and you know, we have some excellent programs that are actually doing a lot of amazing work in our high schools, including concurrent enrollment, which has been proven to be one of the biggest drivers of Hispanic or Latino enrollment into the Tulsa Tech and Tulsa Community Colleges. So helping families understand what opportunities are available so that they can find a career. Also, starting, you know, even in middle school, getting those children involved with hands-on activities and visiting programs like Junior Achievement locally here in Tulsa, like that has a huge impact on a child's life. If you can remember when you were younger, when you visited maybe some workplace or someplace that gave you a hands-on experience on what a work day might be like as a professional or maybe as a specialist, you know, can make a big impact. And then also from the youth perspective, but then also from the parent family perspective, caregiver perspective, lifelong learning is something that we really value in community schools. We really look at what are ways that we can be improving the lives of our parents, of our caregivers, of our students already in our schools. So not just ESL, but also other career development programs. That is really hard, though, to advocate for, especially for adult education. Locally, I think TPS has cut their adult education program because of lack of funds. Union has been able to figure out a way. I don't know how they figured it out, but Union Public School District still has ESL and GED classes. And that actually has a huge impact, has been proven to have a huge impact on the child's intrinsic motivation for wanting to continue school. And I hear that every day on a person-to-person basis, but the research does prove that when the child sees their parent or their caregiver studying and working hard, it's a model for them. So that's something that we think about a lot.
If I may, I'm going to maybe come at the question from a little bit different angle. I think the question originally was, or is, what is the value of employment for a person who is employed? And a couple of things, and I think this transcends sort of economic status or socioeconomic status, but a job actually provides purpose to one's life. It connects an individual with their community. It improves self-esteem, and ultimately it improves the quality of life within our community. And so sort of my worldview causes me to believe that we were created to work, or work is a good thing, and I think that it gives a person a sense of responsibility and an opportunity to contribute to the greater good, to be a part of something greater than just themselves. And we have instances, anecdotally, where some of our participants, when they come in from the day of working and they're given the opportunity to put on some more casual clothes, will keep their work uniform on. And it's because it makes them feel good about themselves. And so I think a job ultimately gives us a sense of identity in a certain sense, in a positive way. It gives us a sense of purpose and a connection to the community that we live in.
Thank you. I think there's a lot to that, and thank you, everybody, for your input. So, Daryl, I saw that you had a question, and while you asked that question, I would like, and I see some more in the back, everyone do me a favor and stand up for a second. Put your phone down. Dim your laptop. I know we're tweeting and doing lots of important things, no judgment, but y'all look a little bit tired, and you've had lots of information. All right, Daryl, let's hear our question about opportunity. Or maybe not, you know, whatever your question is. Thank you. That was a really great question. If you would like, you may sit down. You can remain standing if you want. I'm going to repeat the question for recording purposes. So I learned about this from David, actually. The cliff effect is what he would describe it as. Would anyone like to comment on what you think either policy or even the programming that you do can do to alleviate or get around or eliminate, perhaps, the cliff effect that comes with suddenly being ineligible for a support that you have been relying on once you get just enough extra income to survive.
Sure. And speaking of David, I want to say thank you for slotting me in the afternoon the day before the conference is over at 3 o'clock. That's a great time frame to keep everyone's attention.
He knew I'd keep them on their toes.
Yeah, that's right. It's a great time frame. So I think first of all, I think it's a keen observation, and I think it's a very real issue that does have a negative impact, for sure, and good for you for that observation. I think from a policy standpoint, perhaps the answer may be to phase out, phase towards, so like what we would call a step-down effect instead of the cliff effect, where you just reach that certain point and it's kind of all or nothing and you fall over the cliff, but phase it out so that it's a more of a gradual sort of path to self-sufficiency. If I could say it that way. So So ultimately, I think what we want to do is protect those incentives, because obviously you need to have the assistance as you work toward that goal. But perhaps a better, and we see the same sort of thing with Medicaid eligibility and some other programs that exist. But I think what we would want to do is implement perhaps a step down or a step up phase, however you would want to word that, so that it's not you get to that point and you lose everything, but it's sort of more of a gradual sort of transition.
Mm-hmm. Christy?
So from the tribal perspective, there are particular tribal programs that we're having to work with and particular funding sources. So I'll just mention a few pieces where the policy is important. As a coalition, we've realized that we had to go in and ask for administrative policy guidance from TANF, the Tribal TANF Central Office in Washington, D.C., to say, for example, if we're going to work with tribes and set up these children's savings accounts, would a parent that's getting tribal TANF become ineligible? And we got administrative policy guidance that they would not, and that they just have to put it in their tribal TANF plan, and we have some more particulars about that. So we have that guidance posted, and we've distributed that to our constituents. So that's where sometimes these roles for Native Asset Building Coalitions come in play, because it gets really nitty-gritty, and we have to go ask these specific questions. Obviously there needs to be some more work about checking on asset limits and making sure that people aren't penalized for participating.
Can you talk a little about what an asset limit is?
Yeah. So, for example, per program, when Kate showed that poverty table, is like percentage of poverty. So it can depend per program, but, if you make above this, then obviously you would become ineligible. So it's kind of getting back to your question there. But with those individual development accounts, and these are available to tribes and to any kind of nonprofit, these individual development accounts, if you have, depending on the source of funding used for that program, if you go with the largest federal source of funding in the United States, which is called AFI, or Assets for Independence, they do have a no disregard in federal benefits provision in the legislation there. And so we often have to show that letter to make sure that people don't lose any benefits by participating in the program. Sometimes there's not those protections if you have some other flexible sources of funding, but then from a tribal perspective, there are sometimes that if the tribe is doing some social services and they have more flexible funding, that we can kind of make sure that people don't have to lose benefits. So it really varies, and it gets kind of complicated, but those are the things we have to play with all the time. Yeah.
And I just want to add a little bit to that. Asset limits are, it's a sort of interesting and counterintuitive thing. You obviously don't want to be using what are increasingly scarce federal or state resources for people who don't need them. But at the same time, if the goal, as we talked about during my presentation, is to get someone or for someone to work towards self-sufficiency, in many states, and depending on the program, there are all kinds of different asset limits, which means that you may qualify, you may earn a very low wage and be a single parent, or you may have, be unemployed and be a single parent, really need, food stamps or need access to TANF while you're in school. But if you save money, if you save in some states, up to $2,000, $5,000, you are no longer eligible. So that means the entire time you're on that program is a disincentive to become more financially stable. You can't or you shouldn't save if you're going to need that benefit. So it's, I think it speaks again back to your great original question, Daryl, that the cliff effect that intensifies that effect. That means when you run out of eligibility for that temporary support, you also weren't saving any money while you were in the program. And they also have asset limits for things like automobiles. If you have a car worth over a certain amount, you might not be eligible in some states for TANF, which if you really think about it, is just really irrational because you're going to need to get to that job training that they are providing for you. Good question.
That's a really good question.
Anybody want to jump in?
Go ahead. Okay. I love your question. Directly, I think community schools really, health and wellness is definitely one of our core components. And so we do work with Tulsa Health Department to do some kind of programming for the children and some for families. My program specifically, though, we are still developing something that would be health literacy for Latino families. There are already some really excellent programs in the community.
Will you say what health literacy means to you?
Oh, to me? Let me just be clear on this. Mm-hmm. Health literacy to me not just includes being able to read a label, but also I think to me I would define it as being able to identify which are the ingredients that are actually nutritious for you, and you know, be able to understand like the pros and cons of food depending on where they come from and depending on like how they were processed or treated, and I think that is something that definitely impacts the Latino community very very much so. However, I would also include the cultural aspect of it, because a lot of times we have a lot of wonderful federal programs that, you know, want to help families eat healthier, want to help families cook healthy meals, you know, and healthy processes. However, they do not include the cultural aspect of it. So, for example, you know, a lot of our families, we love our tortillas and frijoles and arroz. You know, and that's something that we are going to want to eat for a long time. So it's a matter of working with that, and it's a matter of helping us understand, okay, what are proportions? And a lot of our food, unfortunately, has become unhealthy because of certain subsidies for companies, and I can go about that, but I'll not.
That's a subject for another panel, perhaps.
But, you know, it's something that also affects our children's ability to think and learn if they don't have healthy food. And, you know, it's interesting, too, because a lot of our families struggle to afford healthy food, especially if they, you know, are on that cliff effect, which I just learned. but also, you know, it's also something that I think culture really ties into it, especially because of our immigrant families. They really do. You know, food for us is not just something that we just sustain ourselves. It's also a spiritual thing. It's also something that sustains our mind and body. So I think that is something that we're looking at. How can we include health literacy in some of our programs already that are going on? And then how can we be more robust in working with other health literacy initiatives to be more culturally competent? So if you have any suggestions, let me know.
Well, you guys can hook up afterwards. Thank you. It looks like there were a few other panelists that had a response.
Go ahead, Chris.
Please. No, defer. Please, go ahead.
Do I have to intervene here?
Have Chris go.
Okay.
Okay. Very, very quick. What is your name?
Janice.
I was going to tell you, I just kind of recently came under conviction because literally, let me just tell you how bad things are at Team. We have planned this Thursday a prison cake cook-off. We serve three different yards, and a discussion ensued on who could make the best prison cake in the microwave. And anyway, we're absolutely doing it, and I'm going to be a judge. So let me tell you the serious side of things. We actually had incorporated health literacy into our curriculum at Team, but we've since taken it out, and I'm just going to tell you the dynamic. The dynamic is unless a person sees the value in is willing to participate and take advantage of that information, we found that it wasn't perhaps the best use of time. And I also say that it's awfully hard to instill into the life of a person who is in crisis or who feels like they're in crisis that they really need to start planning how to eat healthier, you know. And so it's just trying to take it one step at a time. And I think, based not only for individuals who are in poverty, but really just the overall health indicators for our state as a whole, health literacy is absolutely the way to go. Education, information, incentives for businesses or for communities to incorporate healthier practices and policies are really, I think, important. What we've done instead of trying to maybe force that information, and this is not, I'm not saying this well at all, but instead of trying to offer that information to a person who's not ready to receive it, we've kind of taken a step back and begin to implement some healthier policies within our staff to try to lead by example and to try to demonstrate, at least show the importance of healthier choices, you know, in our day-to-day living. And we're constantly evaluating our curriculum. And because of your question, I think we'll evaluate it sooner rather than later to see if there's not a way to at least incentivize some of that literacy back into what we're doing.
Thank you. And Christy, if you had a response, you could just keep it relatively short. We do have a whole panel dedicated to healthcare system in Oklahoma. So we can talk more about that when we do that panel.
Okay, I'll be brief. When we're doing native asset building, we think about assets very broadly, so not just as money. So assets as health, food security, sovereignty, so tribal sovereignty, native language, education, community, all those things. And so what we keep promoting is that there are ways to design even a financial education camp for youth that have these pieces intertwined, and we don't have to fit into a cookie cutter program that doesn't work. And so there are some individual development account programs or those match savings where people are saving for kind of more food security or mobile aquaponic units and things like that. And so, for example, Choctaw Nation has this graduate that does this mobile aquaponic unit, and then they're working in Kiowa Public Schools, and they're teaching the kids how to grow their own produce, and then they feed them the food in the cafeteria. So that would be an example of kind of where this all integrates, and we try to promote as many of those models as we can.
That's very cool. And we have a lot of questions. We still have plenty of time, so don't get too antsy if I don't call on you right away. We have a question over here, and then I'm going to put a question forward to the whole panel. Great question. Anybody have any? Christina?
Well, in terms of some of the youth that we have in part of Conexiones Network, we have several who have been diagnosed with certain, most of them have been learning disabilities, but some of them also have issues with mobility. And so it's a matter of really struggling to find resources that support their needs, but then also advocating on their behalf, because a lot of times, you know, they do get kind of brushed aside because, oh, they're a child that has an IEP or something like that. And so really working with the family to teach them advocacy skills so that that family can also communicate really effectively with the teachers on what their child needs. So it's more up from a youth perspective, and more like from what, in terms of family and school perspective. That's how I would say that we include the children and youth with disabilities. As far as employment and job training, we actually have a couple parents who have disabilities, either because they were born with it or they were injured on the job. And so we're looking at ways that we can, kind of more on a relationship basis, plug them into different opportunities that can use their assets, because they do have amazing assets, and I really wish that they could be included more. But in terms of a systemic way, we're still working on that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. My mic has taken a little... its own accord has decided to... All right. So I'm going to throw a question out to everybody on the panel, and we can just start with the panelist to my left, and talk about team. You each mentioned in your introduction in some way collaboration with community partners. And I would love to hear about how, not so much public attitudes, although I think that certainly plays a role, but how do attitudes or political ideologies or just sort of opinions that folks have about either the poor or the community that you work with, or about programming to enable access to opportunity, how do those attitudes affect the availability of collaborators, or have you worked with a business or a group that has surprised you, the attitude they have, and what are your biggest barriers in terms of that stigma or getting the message across about the importance of your work?
It's a great question. Let me go back and touch on just a couple of things. Let me say first to Brittany.
Yeah.
Brittany, that we, when we are able when we're introduced to an individual who has disabilities beyond our ability to effectively assist, we refer to one of our partners in the community. There are nonprofits in the greater Oklahoma City area who specialize in assisting individuals with disabilities, and so we make sure and try to get that person connected with the appropriate entity that would most benefit them and help them reach their full potential in finding employment and adding to the community. And then I'll go back a question beyond that and say that when we were talking about health, I know that immediately we focused on physical health and physical health initiatives, but there's also mental health, emotional health, that's every bit as important as the physical health. And we have partners that come in that actually provide mental health and substance abuse treatment and family reunification services to try to help with the emotional and mental health aspect. But ultimately, we're finding it's a matter of education and trying to reiterate to our partners in the community the value of collectively working together. We say consistently that we believe that there's no such thing as a spare Oklahoman, and that our communities benefit when everyone's able to contribute in positive and productive ways. And the surprising thing is, and it's an employer at a time, but we've had some employers who have stepped up and have started looking to team to hire. I mean, they literally are coming into our organization and conducting the interviews in-house for our participants because they see the value in not only helping their business, but they also feel like they're able to address a social issue that they want to be a part of the solution. And so I think as much as anything, the messaging, the communication, the educating on the value of collectively working together to help our neighbor reach his or her full potential is a key piece in trying to strengthen and form the kind of relationships that are ultimately going to benefit all of us and help us achieve our goals.
That's great to hear. Thank you. Christina?
In terms of some biases, the way I would frame it is locally here in Tulsa, the Latino community, majority of them are recent newcomers to the country. And so when I talk about the Latino community and the biases towards them, I also include the immigrant. I also include the undocumented biases too. And unfortunately, and this is also in dealing with even people who want to be sympathized to the cause, there are a lot of misconceptions. There are a lot of confusion that can come up, and there's also a lot of even cultural bias within the Latino community. So that's something that doesn't get talked a lot about, but we really try hard with especially the education workers, the teachers, to help them understand what does it mean to work with a Latino family, especially if they're monolingual Spanish speakers, and how an English monolingual Spanish speaker can actually be more culturally competent than possibly a person born in Latin America, because we do actually in Latin America suffer a lot from social classism, and we suffer a lot of that, and a lot of people I've seen even here in Tulsa, people who are born in Central America carry their biases, of course, here. So, and an employer who is well-meaning will hire a person with those social biases, and then that person then perpetuates those biases in their work. So it's a separate thing to be fluent in Spanish, and it's a separate thing to be culturally competent. So that's one of the things that we work really hard to inform local agencies and schools. And You know, and I mean, I'm talking more on a higher level, but then, you know, you have the basic, like, immigrant hate.
Mm. So, unfortunately.
Yeah, and so, I mean, that is what it is. But I think that little by little, we're working with groups like Dream Act Oklahoma, who are very active in putting a face to what it means to be an immigrant and, you know, being successful and working hard. So I think that it's a face-to-face, you know, person-to-person relationship that happens. And, I mean, in the professional development that we've provided with different agencies and schools, we've had some really good feedback and really good positive responses and positive changes within our schools and how they treat with Latino families. So I'm optimistic despite everything. So, yeah.
It's refreshing.
Yeah.
I need that, y'all's optimism. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Do you want to go ahead?
No, please.
I'm kind of the odd.
No, Marilyn, please.
I want to comment that because
20 countywide, I would imagine there are a lot of collaborators that you work with that.
Well, actually, I do kind of feel like the odd man out here today because my organization does not work with individuals as clients, but rather we work with communities and school systems. And so our whole focus on the poverty issue is to ensure that more kids actually graduate high school and then go on and acquire the skills and education they need for a fulfilling career and life-sustaining wage. So just this may take a moment. Just to explain what we did, because we're so adamant in our belief that as a state we've kind of fallen behind in terms of making sure our children understood the relevance of why they were in school. It is not just to get smarter or to pass your test, but it's to ensure that at the end of the game that you can get a job. And we think that message has been lost. So we've carried our story everywhere. We've spoken to the House of Representatives Education Committee, to the Secretary of Education, State School Superintendent. We got the Oklahoma Department of Commerce, even the Governor's Office to endorse our efforts. It's just us. It's just the Southwest Oklahoma Impact Coalition working this pilot program. And we chose Duncan because we had a superintendent who gets it. Literally at a presentation, raised her hand and said, "We're in. This is the most important thing we could be doing in a community." So our partners have just literally run to the table. I think as a state, well, as economic development people, we've bought into the myth that business and industry doesn't care. They're busy doing their manufacturing or whatever else it is they're doing. That's so not true. Our partners include business and industry. They include the Chamber of Commerce, the local school foundation, even the teachers who now make sure that the curriculum they're teaching incorporates some type of career education as a part of that. So important. If we're going to get our children out of high school and into a career, it is my opinion and my board's opinion that nothing could be more important. Because if you look at the data, and you can go online and download reports to your heart's content, but the bottom line is 1 out of 4 ninth graders will not graduate high school. That's a travesty. It's just a travesty, and it contributes to poverty in such a huge way. I don't think that we go back and look at how can we circumvent this. We start by working with kindergartners at the very beginning, showing them the possibilities of life. That's what we do in Duncan, Oklahoma.
Thank you. And actually, definitely, Christy, I want to hear your answer to that question, but I would like a little bit of audience participation for a moment. How many people in the room knew what they wanted to be when they grew up when they were in kindergarten? Everybody did. Y'all are lying now. You at least had some crazy idea of what you wanted to be when you grew up. Did you ever, when you were in kindergarten, did you think about whether that job would be available to you and how much it would pay? Nope. How about ninth grade? Did you think about that? Yeah? How many people had someone at their high school or family community to sit down and not just talk to you about what you wanted to be, but how you were going to get there, whether there would be a job for you at the other end, and how much you were going to get paid? A couple people. It's great. I didn't have that.
Most of us didn't.
Yeah.
Most of us didn't. And there's a reason we believe that teachers' kids become teachers. Doctors' kids are more likely to be physicians, so on and so forth. And that's because they know the pathway to get there. So many kids who do finally graduate high school have no clue. They go off to college, they have no clue. So we're working on that.
I think that was an accidental bell. Thank you for your input. Christy?
Okay. And just also to clarify, we aren't a direct service provider in terms of our coalition. We really kind of target the program directors within tribes and then Native nonprofits that are then going to try to implement these programs and work with them and help them tease out how to make this all a reality. And so we don't find that it is at all a hard sell to get tribes on board to say that asset building is a great idea. I mean, that's not the problem. Generally, the problem is lack of funding. And so we're really struggling to try to make sure we can get some other funding sources in to make this thing work. I even had a recent conversation with someone from a very large national foundation who asked me, even after they called me to talk to me about funding, to explain and make the case for why it's good to fund Native projects, like in terms of scope and timing, because we had to like prove that this would be something that they think is a valuable thing to do. So there's this kind of misnomer, I think, largely within philanthropy that it's not worth it to try to fund in Native communities. And so there's really been, especially in the asset building field, a great reduction in some of the funding opportunities that are available, and that makes our life a little harder. I think sometimes people think, well, tribes are flush with cash. If they have some gaming, then why on earth do they have to do asset building? Even some of the tribes that do have productive gaming enterprises, and again, that's not of the 566 federally recognized tribes, you know, generally a third may have them, or up to closer to a half now, but some of them do great and some don't. And they're supposed to serve social services, and the reason they are supposed to do that is because the federal government doesn't keep up with the trust responsibilities that it said it would do when we signed treaties. So, I mean, we don't have money to pay for social services, so tribes have gone with where they can, which sometimes is gaming. They try to diversify, and a lot are engaged in a lot of opportunities to do that. But even with those tribes that have productive gaming enterprises, after you've had so much asset stripping in tribal communities, it's just generations of work to repair, to try to get people to be able to either have the opportunities for savings habits and the opportunities for the programs, and then try to figure out how to go. So those are some of the things that we run into that make things a little bit difficult, but I would say that tribes are strongly supportive when they understand what the opportunities are.
Great, thank you. Those were all very interesting responses. All right, we got 20 minutes left. I think we probably have time for two or maybe three more questions. I see two right now, and I'm going to start in the back, and let's make it a good one. 20 minutes, end of the day. I think you're cheating on your interactive policy project. Is that your group?
No.
Okay. Okay. So do we have any thoughts on, I think, the federal minimum wage, but also a living wage? What does that mean to you and your work and opportunity?
So, I will tell you, I am not a proponent of a mandatory minimum wage increase.
We'll let you stay.
I was going to say, I know your audience, right? That's what they always say. However, I'm a proponent of incentives over mandates. I mean, that's just sort of my general philosophy. And I will tell you that what we do at Team is we seek out opportunities that our average beginning wage for a participant who obtains employment through our organization is like $9.25 an hour. And we look for those kind of jobs, and we focus on those kind of jobs, and we absolutely promote those businesses to the hilt within our community, in trying to establish better relationships and maybe even encourage others to follow suit. And I can tell you that my thought is a job is better than no job sometimes, and we understand that sometimes you have to, especially given the fact that a person may be in the process of rebuilding their life or just entering the workforce, or they may have to start kind of at the lower end, but we don't want to stay there, and we want to continue to provide opportunities, and the phrase that has been used is a career pathway, so that they can increase. And so ultimately I think the way to achieve probably what you're suggesting ought to be achieved is through strengthening our economy, maybe through some other policies, and be happy to get into that later, or encouraging and incentivizing sort of the direction that you would want to go or that we would want to go.
So I would ask you to elaborate, but they have all been broken into small groups and assigned major policy debates. And one of those debates is, do the costs of raising the minimum wage outweigh the benefits? So you've just already given one group some good ammunition. Yeah. But no, of course, thank you for your input. No, I'm just teasing. Michael had a question, and then we'll go to the back.
So TEAM provides assistance for that. We will provide and help pay for whatever level of education our participants choose to pursue, so long as it's directly related to a career that they are pursuing or interested in pursuing. And we're able to do that through a U.S. Department of Labor grant that encourages that kind of training. I'll tell you very quickly, because I don't want to monopolize the time, that all of our participants, and I sort of had a light bulb moment when I came to TEAM and realized that in any given year, as far back as I could see based on our statistics, that about 65 to 70% of the individuals who were coming to our organization for help with job placement or employment sort of services had been impacted by incarceration. About 70% in any given year had been impacted by incarceration, but they were coming to TEAM for help after they had been released and tried to make a go of it on their own. They couldn't find a job, couldn't find a place to live, and they were in dire straits. And it's awfully hard to put together a proactive life plan for an individual who's just trying to figure out where they're going to sleep tonight or where their next meal is coming from. And so what we decided to do is completely change our service model and begin to work with an individual at a point in time that's going to make the biggest and most lasting difference. So all of our participants who are in-house or currently incarcerated, we begin the process 6 months prior to release. And then our service model lasts for 18 months. So it starts 6 months prior to release, and we walk with them for another 12 months post-release. And we do that because the statistics indicate that if a person is going to reoffend or recidivate, it's most likely to happen in the first 9 to 12 months after release. And so we have incorporated some key service models that we believe, based on what other states have done effectively, will make a lasting difference. For instance, we have a full-time attorney on staff who does nothing but deal with the legal issues facing our participants, again, prior to release. We've developed a partnership with NorthCare to provide the mental health and substance abuse treatment services. And we're working with employers to say, hey, we'll get this man or this woman work ready. If you'll give them a chance, and if you'll give them a chance, you're not only going to help your own business, but you're going to help their family as well, because we're breaking that cycle. We believe that if we can help an adult sort of get on the path to self-sufficiency and become a contributing member of society, which is what they want to do, we're not only helping that individual, we're helping their children's chances for success grow exponentially. What I found in working with this population is they're no different than me. And truly, but for the grace of God, so go I. I am so glad that I am not known for my worst moment. And I don't know that it's fair that we assign that sort of view to a person who has stumbled and been impacted by incarceration. These are very talented, very gifted individuals who are valuable. They have a lot to offer. They want that opportunity. And I think that from a policy standpoint, we've dug the hole just deep enough that it's almost impossible to get out of. And so we're really trying to change that, and in the course of time, trying to change the face of incarceration within the state of Oklahoma.
Thank you. Yeah, I think that gets an amen or two. Maddie, do you have a question?
No, you don't, but you have some awfully great programs here in Tulsa. Tulsa Reentry One Stop is pretty similar to what we're doing. I don't think they're working pre-release, but maybe they're going to start doing that. Obviously, Women in Recovery is just a creme de la creme of diversion programs in the nation, let alone the state. So you've got some really positive things happening. I would say that it's building a personal relationship. Once you get your foot in the door and can establish a relationship with the right person within that company and really begin to educate and explain the value of addressing this issue, I think you'll have them. I think inherently they know. And we believe, as Oklahomans, that people deserve a second chance. I mean, that's sort of part of our fabric. I will tell you that about a month ago now, I had the opportunity to participate in a discussion at the White House. And the president and the U.S. Department of Labor and the U.S. Department of Justice and Council of State Governments had established an event that was focused on businesses like Home Depot that have offices nationwide who have gone above and beyond to internally change their employment practice policies. And several businesses that have stores throughout the United States have internally implemented a Ban the Box initiative, so they don't exclude an interview based on a person's criminal background. In the last 2 weeks, Senator Rand Paul, who is known for being extremely conservative, has introduced legislation at the federal level called the REDEEM Act, and it basically seals the criminal record for all nonviolent offenders so that can't be used against them in employment practices. Paul Ryan just recently introduced his welfare reform initiative, and it also includes correction reform initiatives as well. So I think slowly but surely the light bulb may be coming on, and some good things are happening. And I think if there's ever an issue that we can all work together and agree to find some reason to support, it would be the issue of criminal justice reform. And so I want to say thank you for what you're doing. Don't give up. Continue to fight the good fight and just try to build those personal relationships.
Okay. So I have one final question for every person on the panel. I would say rapid fire, but we have about 10 minutes left, so a few minutes apiece would be great. So you each deal with, I don't want to say intractable problems in every case, but you know, big systemic or population-wide issues, or you know, a lot of institutional moving pieces in many cases, and in some cases, bias, you know, misunderstanding. It's tough work, and I'd like to hear a little bit from each of you about what gives you hope in Oklahoma for the work that you do, and sort of what keeps you going, and what are you excited and hopeful about in your work. And if you are ready, Christy, I'd love to start down there and move this way.
Okay, sure. So I'm very excited about the options. You know, there's so much opportunity with the tribes in the state to do some really innovative asset building programming. And we keep having more and more interest in our meetings. And so those things kind of keep me going. We also have a really supportive leadership team of other native asset building practitioners, and I really respect their work and appreciate the opportunity to collaborate with them. These children's savings accounts, admittedly, are kind of the soft spot in my heart. You know, I really think that they have a lot of potential, and so if we can get some funding for some pilot children's savings accounts, which is what we're working on, I think that we could really show some positive impact in terms of scope. You know, for example, there's some tribes here that are very small. If they had children's savings accounts and we could fund like 400 of them, that would cover every kid in the tribe, 0 to 18. You know, we could really show some impact and then be able to help people build this kind of nest egg of savings, offer financial education that is culturally relevant and competent, and I think it would be very exciting. So those are the things that kind of keep me going on a daily basis, and I'm hopeful that we'll keep kind of moving in that direction.
One by one, our Oklahoma communities are coming on. So we started the pilot in Duncan. Thursday, Seminole launches their community. It's their community launch of Career Pathways. Muskogee, some of you may be from these towns, has built a team. Weatherford, Oklahoma, is interested in doing Career Pathways. And I know just like anything else, you have to demonstrate success This is not a short-term process that we're working on in terms of guiding children, providing them the career education and guidance that they need in order to succeed in life. It'll be a long time before we know if our efforts have been successful, but I just see enthusiasm across the state from various communities. Durant, so we're in all four corners, really, and I just believe it's the right thing to do. It's not expensive. It's not a project. It's not a program. It's a philosophy about how we teach our children.
Bright spots? I think when I think about some bright spots federally, I think that the Latino community all across the nation is growing, and we're learning more and more about what our rights are. We're learning more about how we can organize and the way we can share our voice with local politicians and local policies too. So I'm feeling like there's no option but momentum because we are growing. And I think locally here in Tulsa, we have Tulsa Public School District. This is the first year where the Latino students surpass all other minority groups. So we're the second biggest minority, and pretty soon we'll probably be the biggest ethnic group. And I feel like this is helping push the urgency in terms of targeted programs like soccer, like Spanish translators, and other things that promote the success of our, you know, big driver of population growth here in Tulsa. So I think that every day I see a little bright spot of somebody who wants to get on board and is also like questioning themselves, like, how am I preparing my agency, or also how am I catering to the Latino community? So and I also am excited because I am seeing more and more youth, Latino youth, who are also asking the right questions and participating and in civil discourse. So I think that is my biggest bright spot too, is the young people and seeing them get involved. And I keep on to those really tightly.
Well, what provides me hope and sort of the driving force that keeps me going is seeing a person in the process of rebuilding their life, and to see hope instilled in the life of that person again. There's nothing more beautiful in my estimation than that. I believe that addressing the issues that we're talking about today is the right thing to do. Inherently, I believe that it's what we should be doing, and collectively, not just individually. I want to be a part of something greater than myself. I like the synergetic effect when we get to work together as partners. But ultimately, what gives me hope, I think, is you. And when David had asked if I would participate, yeah, all of you collectively, not Dr. Fever, all of you. When David asked if I would participate in this event, without hesitation, I said yes, because I hear a lot, and it bothers me that Oklahoma is short on financial resources. I hear that we're short on policy initiatives. I hear that we're short on positive outcomes, and I understand that, and I absolutely see the areas that we need to improve. But at the same time, I do not believe that we're short on talent. I do not believe that we're short on intellect or ideas or strong work ethic. And so when I get to come to an event like this and see literally the future of our state, I have all kinds of hope. So thank you.
Thank you. The microphone is failing me. Can we give this panel another round of applause commensurate with their contribution here? I hope we gave each other a little bit of hope. And I have one last thing to say. Can you guys guess what it is? What have I been saying every day, all day? Yeah, words. Please fill out your evaluations of the last two panels when you get them in your email, and we will see everyone at the Jazz Hall of Fame. Tyler, did you need more logistic?
Jazz Hall of Fame will start at 6:30. The parking is on the south side of the building on